I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, with the Midday News Wrap. Today we'll speak with David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian, about the political fallout from the conviction of President Trump's associates Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen. We'll gauge reaction on Capitol Hill and the White House, and assess the impact that this latest scandal could have on the midterm elections. Then, the Real News Network reporter Stephen Janis and Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Gene Marbella join me for a rundown of local news stories, including how the firing of Andrea Mason from the state's attorney's office could impact a possible fourth trial in the Keith Davis Jr. case, the continued fallout from the Gun Trace Task Force investigation, and Maryland's Catholic community's reactions to a Pennsylvania grand jury report that detailed the sexual abuse of more than 1,000 children at the hands of the clergy. The Midday News Wrap starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. Tom took this week off because, let's face it, it's the middle of August, the doldrums of the summer news cycle. It's not like there could possibly be any news to cover in our Friday news wrap, is there? Okay, maybe there is. There's a lot to talk about, with a conviction and a guilty plea in the cases of two of President Trump's associates and an increasingly contentious relationship between Trump and his Attorney General Jeff Sessions. We'll talk about some of this with David Smith, the Washington Bureau Chief of The Guardian. He's joining us from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. Good to talk to you again, David.
You too. Hello.
Hello. And of course, we're glad to talk to you as well during this hour. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or email us midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And let's start with Michael Cohen. For years, an attorney for President Trump, on Tuesday, he pleaded guilty to multiple crimes, including two campaign finance violations. And he implicated the president without actually using Trump's name, saying he paid hush money to two women to silence them about alleged affairs with what he calls the candidate's knowledge and his direction. And of course, we know that the candidate here is Trump, right?
Indeed. Yes, it did not take a genius to work that out, especially I think somewhere in the documents it said the person went on to become president of the United States.
Not using the name. The president says the payments did not represent a campaign finance violation. What do we know here?
Well, we now, despite the president's denials and what the Washington Post is now calling a lie, that Donald Trump, first of all, we seem to have all accepted without much comment that he actually had extramarital affairs with two women, a Playboy model and a pornographic film actor, and it's a sign of the times that is passing on us without comment, although Trump, I think, still denies it. But we know that these payments were made at a crucial point in the 2016 election, I think, October. If you remember the blow that the Access Hollywood tape had, this could have been devastating. And so this plea bargain from Michael Cohen mentioned it was to influence the election. And Michael Cohen has now decided to come clean and plea guilty to these various charges, including these two campaign finance violations. I mean, effectively implicating the president in a crime. And we've seen Trump this week characteristically try to find various explanations that he only knew about them later, which directly contradicts something he said before, or that it came out of his own money and therefore does not count as a campaign finance violation. Or at another point, he said, well, Barack Obama had a campaign finance violation too, so what's the big deal? However, what we also know is that, at least in criminal terms, Trump seems to be safe for now because Justice Department guidelines say that a sitting president can't be indicted. So it's a huge political scandal, but I suspect one that will not shake Trump's base and really leaves us with a lot more questions in terms of what will Michael Cohen now tell special counsel Robert Mueller? Because we've heard from Cohen's lawyer that he's willing to sing like a canary, so to speak. And even today and yesterday, we've heard about the owner of the National Enquirer and Trump's chief financial officer receiving immunity to speak to this Cohen investigation. So there's a lot going on, very, very murky waters, and really a sense that the Trump presidency is now tainted by actual criminality.
Let's try to wade into those waters just a little bit. The CEO of the company that publishes the National Enquirer, David Pecker, got immunity, as you mentioned. The National Enquirer paid for the rights to the story of Trump's alleged affair with former playmate Karen McDougal. What do we know there? What could this person have told prosecutors?
Yeah, I mean, we know a very interesting backstory about the National Enquirer burying stories that could be damaging to Donald Trump, and this whole concept of catch and kill. And in the last 48 hours, there have been renewed reports that really, I think since around 2010, any scandalous story about Trump was, quote, dead on arrival. It would just go into the National Enquirer safe and not be published. So this is a magazine that ran a lot of anti-Hillary Clinton propaganda during the campaign, has very much been on Trump's side. And so the idea that its owner may cooperate with the legal authorities in New York must be very worrying for Trump. In a much used metaphor, he knows where a lot of bodies are buried, and that includes, as you say, the Karen McDougal case, one of the women who alleges she had an affair with Trump. But it could also cover a lot of other issues as well, both sexual and financial, and it really continues one of the ironies, one of the paradoxes of all this, that it started as an investigation into alleged collusion with Russia, but it's actually uncovering a whole swathe of other issues and alleged crimes.
Other issues possibly with the Trump Organization. As you mentioned, the man who had served as that organization's chief financial officer has also been granted immunity. What could come out of that?
Yes, that is also fascinating, and that's a development within the last two hours,
I think. Yeah,
yeah. First reported by the Wall Street Journal, and you know, this is a man whose knowledge of the inner workings of the Trump Organization is probably second only to Trump himself. He's been the executive vice president and chief financial officer for decades. So we're really reaching a stage now where Trump's inner circle are being asked to testify against him,
and some are,
if this gentleman does, there'll be very few hiding places for the president. And you know, let's just remember one of the fundamental issues. Donald Trump, for example, has still not released his tax returns. That raises a big question mark. His financial dealings with Russia over many years, that's something that this gentleman at the Trump Organization may have some insight on, and a whole raft of other things that we can't even imagine yet relating to the Trump Organization. So really, we, as you suggest there, we're actually seeing several Trump associates turning against him now, when you also consider Michael Flynn and a few others, and therefore it's no surprise that he likes to ultimately surround himself with family members who do remain loyal.
One of the people from Trump's circle that does not appear to be talking to prosecutors, his one-time campaign chair, Paul Manafort, was convicted this week on 8 federal tax and fraud charges. The jury was not able to reach a unanimous verdict on 10 other charges, but apparently that was very close, right?
Indeed, we saw a media interview with one of the jurors afterwards saying that he would have actually been found guilty of all 18, but for one juror who held out, and apparently that juror's reasoning was just the issue of reasonable doubt. So he came very close to 18, and even 8 is very damning, I think, for Manafort and Trump by extension, and also a symbolic victory, if you like, a validation of Mueller's investigation. You can just imagine if all 18 charges had failed, then we would now be seeing a hue and cry from Trump, from Fox News, from others in conservative media saying that this entire investigation is a sham and a hoax and a witch hunt and should be wound up. So the stakes were very high and Mueller prevailed. It was also very instructive to see Trump's different reactions to the Cohen and Manafort cases, which, of course, very dramatically unfolded within a few minutes of each other on Tuesday afternoon. Cohen, he's been sarcastic about and said, you know, if you want a good lawyer, don't hire him and so on. Whereas Manafort, he's repeatedly praised as a good guy who refused to turn and brave and so on. And that has obviously raised some speculation that he may ultimately pardon Paul Manafort and by doing so perhaps send a message to other associates who are considering whether to turn against him or not.
Right. Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani said that Trump had recently asked for advice about granting Manafort a pardon. Now, of course, Manafort's got another trial coming up, and the charges that the jury couldn't reach a unanimous verdict on, those 10, I had been hearing the scuttlebutt saying, well, they're not going to bother to recharge them. And then I am hearing the opposite now that it turns out it was so close in deliberations that there was only one vote away. I'm hearing, well, maybe they will come back and charge him. What would those charges, what would the additional case, what does that all mean for the possibility of a pardon?
Yeah, I was at some days of that of the Manafort trial, and it was hard to see how he could escape on any of the 18 charges. So I think they do have a strong argument on those outstanding 10. However, you know, I think for the average citizen watching this from afar, you know, ultimately they're all financial crimes. I don't think there was a sort of huge substantive distinction between the 8 he was found guilty of or the 10 he was cleared of. Certainly, in terms of the bigger picture of Trump and Russia and what it all means in that wider context, and indeed when you sat in that courtroom hour after hour, I have to say, you know, Donald Trump in the White House felt quite far away. Trump was only a tangential figure in there who was just mentioned a few times. You know, the issue of Russian collusion was not tackled head on by any means. But yeah, ultimately, look, Manafort has, you know, yet another trial to come. He's already completely in the mire on this. We also know that Donald Trump is not a details guy. So frankly, whether Manafort is ultimately convicted on 8 charges or 80, I don't think it's going to change Trump's political calculation much as to whether to pardon him or not.
Democrats in Congress have been reacting very strongly, many are urging to delay the hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. But Republicans in Congress appear to be saying very little as possible, at least publicly, right?
And we've heard that story before, haven't we, with many Trump controversies, Charlottesville, the Helsinki summit with Putin, lackluster response to Puerto Rico and all the others. It's a constant game trying to get Republicans to say anything and speak out. Some have express concern. I mean, some of the usual Republican critics perhaps have expressed concern over, you know, these people being anywhere near the White House and the president. But I think yet again they are ultimately conscious that the Trump base will be unshaken by this. That as far as in from their perspective, there's not much political advantage in speaking out about it. And it sort of spoke volumes yesterday when Mitch McConnell was asked some questions and just left a very prolonged silence. You know, where Republicans have got fairly accustomed to this now of trying to excuse or just remain silent when Trump's indiscretions emerge. And there seems very little enthusiasm for really taking him on or, you know, any kind of impeachment proceeding.
Yeah, it's all about that base, because Trump's base is incredibly loyal to him, as we understand from the polls. I'm wondering what this is going to potentially mean for the midterm elections. As long as the base remains so loyal, could this actually end up helping the Republican Party? The specter of impeachment keeps being brought up, but it seems like it's almost always being brought up by Republicans and not by Democrats who would actually be doing it if such a thing were to happen.
Yes, and I think that is the great clue, isn't it, as to who will benefit from lots of impeachment talk. Democrats really want to play it down. I think for both principle and strategic reasons, on principle, many of them genuinely believe that it's too early, that Mueller's investigation should be allowed to run its course, and that to act now would be to politicize it unnecessarily. But equally importantly, there's the strategic argument that impeachment will not do much to energize the Democratic base in the elections, because they're pretty energized already, and we've seen that in special elections. There's a huge anti-Trump backlash. They're leading in polls. There's not much more to gain, but there is a lot to lose in terms of the view that it seems to be the one thing that Nancy Pelosi and Steve Bannon pretty much agree on, that if impeachment becomes a really big issue, then that really could activate the Republican base. People will not stay at home, but they will turn out in droves, because they'll be motivated by the fear that Democrats are seeking to delegitimize and effectively overturn the result of the 2016 election. It really could be a rallying cry for Republicans. And therefore, you see, apart from some on the left, you generally see Democrats playing a cautious game, playing it down, just allowing the news to take care of itself. They don't really have to add fuel to that fire right now.
Another thing with a possible impact on the midterms, the fate of Jeff Sessions. Trump is continuing to fault his attorney general for recusing himself from the investigation into Russian interference in the presidential race 2 years ago, but that's not a new thing. What is new is that Sessions appears to be actually fighting back. Yesterday, Sessions said his Justice Department will not be improperly influenced by political considerations. And in response this morning, Trump took to Twitter to tell Sessions what he should be investigating with the Justice Department. What do we make of this? Is telling someone by Twitter what to do an attempt to influence?
Again, it's all pretty staggering, isn't it? And once more, in any other week, this would be sort of dominating every headline. But in the week of Cohen and Manafort, it's almost a footnote. It's this very public feud between the president and his attorney general. I guess in the sense that we've been told Trump's tweets are official policy, then yes, he is trying to influence his attorney general. And the tweets you mentioned today have got a long list of some of the usual.
And all of them specifically addressing him, Jeff.
Indeed. And some of the usual conservative tropes about we should be investigating Hillary Clinton and Democratic collusion and so on. Curiously, there was also a media report yesterday that after their initial spat conducted via statements and tweets and Trump's Fox News interview, Trump and Sessions apparently had a meeting at the White House for quite some time where it wasn't even mentioned. So it is all very bizarre. Some of it is sort of classic Trumpian public display and showmanship, but it really does seem now that the writing is on the wall for Jeff Sessions. I was struck that Senator Lindsey Graham, who spends a fair amount of time with Trump, just a few months ago was saying that if Sessions is fired, there'll be hell to pay, and then just yesterday had changed his tune and was saying that Sessions will probably go sooner rather than later, although he hoped not before the midterms. But it's yet another case of a Trump associate falling out of favor. And the one other symmetrical, striking, poetic thing about it, if you like, is the first two members of Congress who endorsed Donald Trump when he ran for president are both now facing criminal convictions, most recently criminal charges, most recently Duncan Hunter in California. And Jeff Sessions was the third member of Congress to endorse Trump, and he's got sort of different troubles. So there does seem to be a curse, and I really should look up who was the fourth member of Congress.
What could happen to the Russian probe should Sessions be seen to the door?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't think it would be terminal. As you said, one of Trump's bones of contention is that Sessions recused himself from that investigation to keep himself at arm's length, having been involved in the Trump campaign and had interactions with the Russian ambassador and so on. So presumably a new attorney general would come in. I'm not sure off the top of my head legally whether that person would take charge or whether it would remain with Rod Rosenstein. But, what's been striking throughout this is that, while there's this back and forth with Sessions, Robert Mueller remains silent and deadly and is just letting his work do the talking and not engaging in any of these public spats, which makes it very hard for Trump to attack him. And makes it extremely difficult for Trump to fire him. And this week again, we saw reporting on what the Democratic plan is if Mueller is fired, and it involves massive demonstrations in the streets all over America and a huge outcry. So I think attorneys general and deputy attorneys general can come and go, but Mueller will march on.
And I'm sure that next week in Washington is going to be just as quiet, given the end of the August that we're heading into. David Smith is Washington Bureau Chief of The Guardian. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, Stephen Janis of the Real News Network and Gene Marbella of the Baltimore Sun will join me for a rundown of local stories. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall with the News Wrap. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. On Monday's edition of Midday, we will be dipping into the archives and revisiting Tom's interview with Sean Yost of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper about his book, Baltimore After Freddie Gray, Real Stories from One of America's Great Imperiled Cities. Right now, we continue with the Midday News Wrap and a look at some of the local stories that have dominated the news this week. I'm joined by Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Gene Marbella. Welcome, Gene.
Nice to be here.
And Stephen Janis, investigative reporter at the Real News Network and co-host of the WYPR podcast Truth and Reconciliation, is here. He's a regular contributor to The Afro. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And listeners, you're also, of course, welcome to be our guests by phone, 410-662-8780, or midday at wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is at @MiddayWYPR. And I want to start this segment with a look at the case of Keith Davis Jr., who's been accused of killing a security guard at Pimlico Racecourse and stood trial on charges there three times.
Three times for murder, once for a handgun. So this will be three times for murder, which is the most important part of it. And the trial, of course, we had two mistrials. One trial where judge threw out or the conviction because of, some questions about a key witness who was a witness that Keith Davis had talked to in jail who had not disclosed that he was part of a drug murder in Texas. So now we have another layer to this story, which is that the prosecutor, Andrea Mason, has been fired for being convicted of a DUI, which just throws another layer in a case that has been absolutely controversial from the onset and continues to sort of embroil the state's attorney's office in controversy. So,
give us a little background about the case, the incident itself.
Well, Keith Davis was accused of shooting a security Pimlico security guard named Kevin Jones, I believe, and, the evidence was always controversial because after the shooting, Keith Davis supposedly took a cab and ended up being shot by police for 44 times, ended up with a gun in his hand. And the controversy has been that, police either planted the gun, and it sort of has played into the whole narrative of police, not being reliable. And so it's a case that's very complex. I mean, basically it's a murder, but it also incorporated all the sort of Freddie Gray and sort of the situation that has enveloped this agency and sort of the many of the aspects of community mistrust that continue to kind of plague it. So it has now been three trials. There's been three trials for murder. The first one ended in a hung jury mistrial. The second one ended in the judge after the verdict, throwing out the verdict. The third trial ended in a mistrial because there was video evidence introduced that the defense said was exculpatory because it showed a suspect walking behind Jones, who they thought was not Keith Davis, but that the prosecutors claim is Keith Davis. A homicide detective in the case actually said he ignored that evidence because he thought it was not exculpatory. So it's a handful of a case, you know.
And none of that evidence came to light until the third trial.
Exactly. Good point. So yes, it's been ever-evolving story. You know, that David Gutierrez, who is the jailhouse witness, you know, said that Davis had, you know, admitted that he took the cab and he had the gun. There's a palm print on the gun, but, you know, the supporters of Keith Davis said that it was planted by police. The gun was planted on him after they shot him. So really, it's one of these cases that there's so many layers, sometimes it's hard to remember where it's going, where it's headed.
And where it's been going is with Andrea Mason, attorney.
Right, so good point. So Andrea Mason has been the prosecutor for the three murder cases. She is a 27-year veteran of the state's attorney's office. And, you know, she was arrested for a DUI about a year ago. She was caught on body camera footage, which is, I would say, you know, objectively embarrassing because she, you know, starts giving the police officer a hard time and saying, this is why we don't like police, because the officer is questioning her. And then she was convicted, and now she has been dismissed. But, you know, I think the contention of the people who support Keith Davis is that she was dismissed after it was found out that the DUI existed.
Yeah, she says that she told her superiors that the DUI existed a year and 2 months ago,
right,
and she was dismissed this week.
Right, and the contention is that she was only dismissed because the media, the Baltimore Sun, found out about it and reported on it, and that it was not something that should have been done earlier. You know, people I've spoken to who are familiar say she's a good prosecutor, but, you know, obviously because this case is so controversial and because people have been putting pressure on Marilyn Mosby to drop it, I think this just adds another element of controversy to it.
Has Mosby's office said anything about this?
They have refused to comment because they say it's a personnel issue. So they have not made a public statement, only the fact that she is no longer with the state's attorney's office. And she has, you know, not spoken out. Her attorney has made a comment. But other than that, nothing really has been said about the case by the state's attorney's office. Nothing about her employment.
What does this mean for the fourth trial? Will there be a fourth trial?
I believe, you know, I spoke to some people I know at the state's attorney's office. I believe there will be a fourth trial. I think they're going to reshuffle. But I think Marilyn Mosby is committed to prosecuting this case because they really believe that Keith Davis is responsible for the murder. So I think the trial will still go forward. I don't think this will be like a fatal blow to the prosecution, although there are some people who suggest, you know, this should be just another reason that the case should be dropped. But I think there will be a fourth trial. I would be very surprised if they don't go forward with it.
It was supposed to happen this fall?
Yeah, it's supposed to happen this fall. There's been no indication that the trial will be delayed. There's been nothing that I've seen in court filings recently that asked for a delay. But yes, the trial is set for this fall. And as far as I know, the prosecution is going to go forward on schedule. You know, the people I talked to said that there is no reason for them to delay. But, you know,
we'll have to keep monitoring.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, the dots have to be connected by the people who support Keith Davis. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no allegation that she was drunk while she was prosecuting the case.
No, whatsoever. Good point.
You know, but this DUI is, you know, it shows the power of the body camera. I mean, it's so humiliating. This, you know, you see this woman, you know, just being very combative with police, and
absolutely,
they're saying, we're going to read you your rights. You can have it in English or Spanish. And she goes, I want it in Spanish. And it just... Yeah, but the dots have not been connected. And there are plenty of prosecutors who probably can take the case forward. We'll see.
Yeah.
That's Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun. And I want to switch gears and talk with you about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Last week, a grand jury report from Pennsylvania showed us what had happened in that state over decades. More than 300 priests identified, more than 1,000 victims. Pope Francis is in Ireland today. Well, he will be addressing the issue. You've been gauging reactions to this from Maryland Catholics. What have you been hearing?
Well, you know, as always, there's the small C church and the capital C church. And the small C church are just people of faith, people who go to Mass, people who send their kids to Catholic schools. And I think we're at this point. I'm not sure if it's, you know, every time one of these big explosive cases comes up, we think, oh, this is it. You know, people are not going to stand for it. But from what I've heard is, you know, people are just outraged. I think it's just the scope of it. You know, it was over the course of 70 years. It was 300 or so or more priests, 1,000 victims. And, you know, much like the Boston case, the Ireland case, the Australia case, the bishops and the other church leaders either turned a blind eye or just transferred these priests around and just tried to make it go away. But it didn't go away. It just made it worse. And so there, you know, just at the grassroots parish level, I think a lot of people are just done. They're like, you know, stop saying we're sorry. What are you going to do about it?
Mm. And I demanding think,
right.
some sort of action.
And real action, not just, oh, we're going to train people. We're going to, you know, we all know this is not right.
The Pennsylvania incident has Maryland ties directly because Cardinal William Keeler, who had been bishop in Harrisburg and Baltimore's archbishop from 89 to 2007, was implicated, accused of letting a priest who was accused of having sex with underage girls in Harrisburg come to Baltimore's archdiocese. Although I understand there were no accusations about that priest after he came
right.
here.
No, I think there were.
Or were there?
But we haven't heard the specifics of it. Mm. And I think it was a very short period of time that he was in active, you know, ministry here. I think, you know, he maybe was, you know, it's so hard to keep these priests straight. But yeah, I think it was quite heartbreaking.
And Keeler had been praised in the past for his actions in related to church sexual abuse.
Yeah. Back in 2002, when the Boston diocese blew up, a lot of archdioceses and dioceses really took some substantive action, and Keeler was one of them. He compiled a list of priests who had been accused, and not even necessarily criminally convicted or anything, but had been accused of improprieties, you know, abuse, molestation, whatever. And there were some dozen, you know, the numbers kept changing, but there were dozens, as many as 70, I think, on that list. And at the same time, he had the legal department go through, or their lawyers go through and find out how much the archdiocese had paid out in settlements to victims. And it was $4.1 million at that point. Since that time, I think, you know, as I was rushing into the studio, I was speaking to Sean Kane, the spokesman for the archdiocese. And he said since that time, you know, more payments have, you know, been allocated to victims or alleged victims. And it's now it's at least $6 million or close to $6 million.
There has been some fallout. A Catholic school that was going to be named in honor of Keeler now will not be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a movement afoot to name it after. Do you remember the name of the Oblati sister? Lang.
I don't.
Lang. I think, yeah, Mother Lang. There's a real push to have her name be put on it. I believe it's a school in West Baltimore. And yeah, I think some people feel very sad about this because when Cardinal Keeler was alive, he was quite beloved. And he also was, in a way that I think his successors haven't quite reached, he was very much a civic leader. It extended beyond the church, although the church is quite large in Maryland, of course. And, you know, he did a lot of ecumenical work. He was quite well known for reaching out to the Jewish synagogues, to the Muslim mosques. And, you know, he was seen as quite, you know, like trying to accommodate these, you know, these revelations that in the past had been hidden. And so I think, you know, his legacy has taken a hit, and it creates a lot of sadness, I think, in town.
What we've learned about the allegations in Pennsylvania was because of the investigation. And there have been more and more calls for State Attorney General Brian Frosch to conduct a similar investigation here. As I understand, last week when his office was asked about it, a spokesperson would neither confirm nor deny the existence of such a probe or say anything more about it. Do we know anything there?
No, that's they've been quite tight-lipped about it. You know, we don't know if they're really discussing it or if they're just kind of leaving it out there as maybe they'll do it, maybe they won't. But yeah, that was, yeah, the fact that this, and of course, there are a lot of survivors here in town, and they would, yeah, they would very much like to see that. You know, the women who were in that Netflix series, The Keepers. They would love to see that happen. There's the whole group who were victimized by John Merzbacher, who taught, he wasn't a priest, but he taught at a Catholic school in South Baltimore. They would very much like to see an official government, you know, grand jury investigation.
And you note in your article that there is an increasingly call for U.S. bishops to consider submitting their collective resignation to the Pope.
Yeah.
What does that call come from?
It started among a group of theologians. I believe someone wrote in the New York Times that, you know, just a lay person stood up, you know, after the revelations and said, "Father," you know, after the homily, "what are you going to do?" And, you know, he said, "Oh, we're going to pray. We're going to do this. We're going to do that." And the person was like, "No, what physically, yeah, what are you going to do? Give us a plan." And I believe one of the academics was sitting in the parish at that point, and so she wrote this letter calling for the bishops to resign or to at least offer their resignations en masse the way the Chilean bishops did. Mm-hmm. I think there were more than 30 Chilean bishops who, after another sex scandal there, offered to resign. And I believe the Pope accepted 3 or 4 of them, but didn't accept the other ones.
That's Jean Marbella, reporter on the Baltimore Sun's investigative and enterprise team. We're also talking with Stephen Janis, investigative reporter at the Real News Network and co-host of the WYPR podcast Truth and Reconciliation with Afro Baltimore editor Sean Yose. He's also a regular contributor to the Afro. Just got a quick note before we go into break that our producer, Sienna Greaves, spoke with State Attorney General Brian Frosch's office yesterday. Their position has not changed. The office does not confirm or deny the existence of investigations. Mm-hmm. So that's where we stand on that now. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. More to talk about when we're back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. And in this week's news wrap, we are focusing on some Maryland news with Stephen Janis of the Real News Network and Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun. I want to talk about the governor's race a little bit now. Seems to be heating up with Republican Larry Hogan launching his first TV ad of the general election season, an ad that Democrats say is inaccurate. What are we hearing about the race from this ad and elsewhere?
Well, you know, Hogan, from a Baltimore City perspective, opened up his Baltimore City office, seems to, you know, be trying to make a footprint here. But, it's interesting because when we were covering the primaries and we were talking to people in West Baltimore about the election, he had some significant support that surprised me in the city. And, you know, as you look, what did the Gonzalez poll say? It was 14 points or something?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, that's a significant lead with, 3 months to go?
Right.
3.5 months. So, mm-hmm. I feel like the biggest moment has been Ben Jealous's, you know, I can't repeat the word on the air, but to me that was
Are you effing kidding me?
Right. That to me, that nothing really has service. I mean, other than the surprise that Ben Jealous, you know, won the primary, which of course no one
right.
thought.
And he won it so handily in all the two counties.
And has tons of money in the bank.
Yeah, I haven't seen, you know, the energy yet of the campaign other than that moment. And, of course, the socialist branding, which I think is going to be more of their strategy than, you know, taxes and things like that.
Yeah. What surprised me is how fast out the gate Hogan was. You know, mm-hmm. as an incumbent, you would expect him to just kind of like, "I'm the governor. Here's $5 million for a new bridge and, you know, in your town." And, you know, just run an incumbent type of campaign. And And contrasting to that, I feel like Ben Jealous has just been, yeah, kind of, okay, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get going here any moment now.
That is true.
It's kind of odd.
His message has been diffuse.
And this whole $1 million ad buy from Hogan's camp is not the only ad promoting Hogan. Well, the other ads are attacking Jealous from the Republican Governors Association.
Right. And people got really sick of those ads because they were like running constantly, it seemed like. But, you know.
And those ads were also criticized.
Right. But maybe Jealous, you know, I think he's running a different kind of campaign intentionally or inadvertently. But maybe people really aren't paying attention. Maybe only people like us pay attention before Labor Day. That's always the traditional.
Let's wait till Labor Day.
So maybe he's got something planned and like the day after Labor Day.
I think he certainly needs to step up the intensity if he's going to overcome that gap, which is just huge.
Right.
And last weekend was the Maryland Association of Counties meeting, to which both Jealous and Hogan were invited to speak. Jealous declined, citing other obligations, so Hogan got to do it alone. Talking about strategy, what is the strategy for Hogan to be the one there and Jealous to specifically not?
Well, I guess Jealous is saying, hey, I'm the outsider. I'm not going to sit with a bunch of county, you know, assistant deputy county, you know, managers. I'm going to be out with the people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would agree that somehow I'm not really sure what Jealous's strategy is. It's not like sometimes you can tell when a candidate has a certain sort of constructed strategy that's meant to touch on one or two things that brings out their strength or weakness. And I haven't seen it. So it's not really clear to me what he's trying to do overall. I mean, you know, he spent a lot of time in Baltimore County because that is a critical sort of, I mean, you guess call it battleground county.
Baltimore County generally goes to state and governor's
Races. And I've seen that. But other than that, I'm not really sure what he's trying to articulate.
And of course, as you said, maybe what's going on is just the stuff that only we pay attention to before Labor Day hits.
You got to think. I mean, it is August. Everyone's on vacation. It's not a great time to pull out your best argument, I think. It'll be dead after Labor Day. So you can't really blame them for maybe being tepid. Maybe it's a smart strategy. Not take all the oxygen out before anyone's paying attention, which could just be what it's about.
Right. And it's interesting, as you mentioned, that he focused on Baltimore County because you see what happened with the county executive race there. Progressive candidate won. And so maybe there's something there that
he's got to do well in Baltimore County. I mean, that's critical. That's critical because, you know, he's not going to do well out in, you know, Worcester County or something.
But he has relatively low name recognition. I mean, didn't he have a poll that came out that said like a quarter of people didn't know who he was?
Right.
So is letting Hogan define him, letting the Republican Governors Association define him this early in the race, even if people aren't really paying attention, isn't that a danger?
I just don't think people are paying attention. But yes, that is a danger because he hasn't run the kind of campaign where it seems like he can run counter to that. And it is true. I mean, that was one problem we had when we went, because we spent a lot of time at the polls and the name recognition on Jealous was low, even among early voters who are people who are supposedly more interested. So I think you're right. He has a name recognition thing to overcome first in some sense, you know, just who is he? And I mean, there was even confusion in the African-American community, whether Ben Jealous was African-American too. So there are a lot of issues there.
And getting back to the whole socialist branding, because the quote that we referred to was Ben Jealous denying he was a socialist because his words were used slightly out of context in an RGA, a Republican Governor's Association.
Yeah, let's put it that way. That was not a great moment for him in terms of the way he handled that. I mean,
and, you know, one of his big claims to fame is, he kind of turned around the NAACP when it was in terrible financial straits. But I think the NAACP doesn't play the role that it used to. Like, we used to know, like, oh, yeah, Ben Hooks or, you know, Julian Bond. It used to be a figure of much bigger name recognition. In Baltimore, it probably is a bigger factor than it would be elsewhere, given our roots. But yeah, I think he's got a lot of ground to cover. And
tagging up on that, because Jealous was, of course, NAACP chair, what is going on, with the Baltimore branch of the NAACP? A big shakeup there?
It's a mess. I mean, this all started with the resignation of the former president, Tessa Hill Alston, and there were a lot of allegations being thrown around, nothing that's been substantiated. But then, just recently, the National stepped in, the National was already kind of, after the Tessa Hill Alston resignation had kind of taken over the chapter, just dismissed, I guess fired, the current president, Flamer, who was, you know, whose membership was suspended by the National for reasons that he said when I spoke to him that he didn't know why. Now, you know, he did mention two checks that he had written to start some fundraising. But really, he claims that he's done nothing wrong. And now he's gone. The National's taken over. The first vice president's taken over. But, you know, when I spoke to Tess Hill Alston, she started talking about allegations, people claiming that she stole money. And she said it wasn't possible to steal money because everything, as a quote I had, everything is transacted through checks, and that she had been putting personal money in to support the chapter for the 7 years that she was president. And if she had all the money back that she had spent on the local chapter of the NAACP, she could go to the Bahamas. That was her quote. So, you know, but the thing is that, you know, you're talking about the history.
Why would National step in?
Well, you know, that. So I called both Stansberry, who is the president of the Maryland, and I called the National. And, you know, they said it was because the chapter was not following the bylaws and the Constitution. But they wouldn't. I asked them about the allegations against Tessa Hill also, and they would not comment or say that there was an ongoing investigation. So it seems to me it's something they want to kind of. You know, it's interesting because the Baltimore branch has been a very active branch. Under Marvin Duck Cheatham, who was the previous president, you know, it won awards for being one of the best chapters in the country for several years, I believe. And this, you know, with the uprising after Freddie Gray, this chapter has been critical in being involved in, you know, I mean, Tessa Hill Alston would regularly appear at press conferences with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake or the police commissioner. And so I think this chapter is considered extremely important. But, you know, what went on behind closed doors and what went on with the money, I think, has something to do with why the chapter why the National has stepped in. I don't have anything from the National telling me that, but just based on what Tessa said to me about, you know, what she believed the allegations were against her, I have to believe that somehow it's management of the finances of the chapter. I have to believe that.
We've got just a couple minutes left, but I want to touch on the Gun Trace Task Force case before we go. Baltimore County Police Officer Michael Woodlawn, who'd been implicated in that case, is apparently no longer with the force. What do we know about his resignation? And are there any more shoes to drop with GTTF?
I think so.
Well, there was another county officer who resigned. They didn't name it. Mm-hmm. He just quietly went away. I think this is just going to ripple and ripple for a long time to come.
Yeah, I mean, Officer Woodlawn was a former Baltimore City police officer who joined the county force in 2012. And, you know, one of the things, I'm sure, when you went to the trial, it was like an ongoing, you know, it's just a continual, like, travelogue of everyone in the department. Because Gondo or one of the other officers, Mondo Gondo or other officers, would drop a name. Right. And suddenly it would become a whole new avenue for exploring, you know, the tendrils of this corruption.
Or a defense attorney would be naughty and just suddenly say.
Yeah.
Like, were you there the day Detective Souter's name was dropped?
Yes.
And that was just like,
oh, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, every reporter, I think their pens drop, their eyes just bugged out.
Detective Sean Souter, of course, the Baltimore detective who was shot fatally in the head with his own weapon.
Yes.
The day before he was set to testify in that case.
In front of a grand jury. In a 2010 case, which was very significant because that expanded the scope of this.
Right.
Because previously, you know, they just had wiretaps from 2016 where they caught Gondo talking about, you know, helping out a drug outfit in Northwest Baltimore or Northeast Baltimore. And so, yeah, it's just been like you said, drip. It just keeps happening. And in this particular thing, they didn't make any announcement about Woodlawn leaving. We just found out about it. And the press did. And, you know, but I asked the spokesman for Baltimore County Police, and he would not comment on either the reasons for his resignation or any sort of anything that happened in a subsequent investigation.
And we should also note that the independent board reviewing the investigation into the death of Souter delivered a draft report to Baltimore's interim police commissioner last week. We could hear about that soon.
Right. Yeah, they have a meeting at 4:15.
Yeah. Oh, so we could hear about it very soon.
And he, of course, was about to testify before the grand jury of the Gun Trace Task Force.
Well, that's all the time we have for the Midday News Wrap today. Such a slow news week. There's nothing left to talk about. Stephen Janis is an investigative reporter at the Real News Network and co-host of the WYPR Truth and Reconciliation podcast. Jean Marbella is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun's investigative and enterprise team. And we've got information about what we talked about today online at wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Monday, we'll dip into the Midday archives and revisit Tom Hall's interview with journalist Sean Yoes about his book, Baltimore After Freddie Gray, Real Stories from One of America's Great Imperiled Cities. Big thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses. Inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s, available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets, online ordering at bottomsupbagels.com. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall today. Thanks for listening to the Midday News Wrap.